Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How has German reunification changed Berlin? November 9th will mark 25 years since the fall of the wall allowed for free passage from east to west and back again. Today, Berlin prides itself on stunning architecture, a thriving tech sector, and a nightclub scene tantalizing enough to rival the 1920s. It's a complicated city as well, having struggled at times with xenophobia, random attacks of violence, and the challenges of breaking down lingering political and psychological barriers. My guest today has been endlessly intrigued by this city, where daily life so often vacillates between beauty and liveliness. Journalist and author Peter Schneider has lived in Berlin on and off since the 1960s, and he has taught at universities including Stanford, Princeton, and Harvard. His new book is called Berlin Now, The City After the Wall. Peter, welcome to Think.
Welcome. Right now I'm in St. Paul.
St. Paul, wonderful. Well, I hope it's not too chilly there. You write that you...
No, it's nice weather. Much nicer than in Berlin right now.
I can imagine. You write that you don't know of any other city in the world that has changed as much for the better as Berlin has in the past five decades. What is it that makes Berlin today so irresistible?
Well, it's a city that is enormously energetic. It's still a poor city, so it's a cheap city. And creative people love it, come from all over the world, come to Berlin. They love the clubs. They love the fact that there is no closing time in the night. You can get the S-Bahn and buses even in 4 o'clock in the morning. And you can spend your night for 10 bucks in some club.
How would you characterize the temperament of citizens of Berlin? Residents are known for being sometimes rather gruff, rather defiant, but it would seem those traits were necessary for survival during the very rough times.
Yeah, they have a certain survival mentality. They are witty. They don't like to obey so much like in other parts of Germany. So they don't have these Prussian virtues that you hear so much about abroad. The Berliners, they like the city, but they also like books that are very critical. If it's witty, they embrace these books. There's not another city I know about which makes a very critical book on Berlin to a bestseller. So they are not very patriotic.
And how does that cause the rest of the country to look at Berlin, the rest of Germany?
Say it again, I didn't get that.
How are Berliners, and how is the city viewed by the rest of Germany?
Well, it's a little bit seen like Washington by the rest of America. So Berlin is a big spender. They always need money. Indeed, the city has an enormous burden of debt. It's 70 billion, can you imagine that? I learned that Detroit was bankrupt with $18 billion debt. I don't know how we make it with 70 billion, but we do. And so, of course, if you ask somebody from Munich, he says, well, they first have to pay their debt, otherwise we won't even talk to them. But nevertheless, they come to Berlin, they like the way of life in Berlin, and there's a fact. Berlin is by far the most popular city in Germany. No, nobody can compare with it.
And yet you explore the fact that beauty and liveliness rarely go hand in hand in Berlin. Can you talk about how it compares, aesthetically at least, with other European capitals?
That's right. As a matter of fact, maybe I delude some of the listeners, but I find Berlin is not a beautiful city. It's rather an ugly city. But ugliness gives the visitor the impression that he is welcome. He still has a chance in the city. In beautiful cities like Paris and London, you know, Everything is already taken. Every apartment, every chance, every work is already taken. You cannot stay there, and you probably don't have the money to stay there. This is so different in Berlin. And by the way, of course, there are beautiful parts, but the city was so much destroyed, and then it was reconstructed so hastily. I mean, if you think that only in a matter of 10 years now, we have reconstructed the whole center of the city, because the center was empty. There was the wall. So, and this makes Berlin built to a city that is never finished, never ready. You always have the feeling it will change by the minute.
It's a work in progress.
Yeah, absolutely.
You write about your experience in having been on the West Side for so long and really felt like the West part of Berlin must have been the center of the city. And then when the wall went down, having full access to the Eastern part of the city and realizing that a lot of the sort of treasures of Berlin had in fact been concealed from you for a long time.
Yeah, you're completely right. I have been many times in the East, but I always felt persecuted by the police. So you would always look into the rear mirror and not really view the city. And it was funny. All of us, I mean, we have lived in my generation, the ones I'm talking about, we have lived in Berlin since the early 60s. But we were amazed that the real center is indeed in the East. And in the East, you find some really nice and decent squares like you would look for them in Paris or in Lyon and other places. So the city actually in West Berlin was not a city. It was really only a part. And now this makes part of the optimism of Berlin as it is now. Now the city is unified and it is breathing again. You have the feeling that you get a lot of air into your lungs if you breathe in Berlin.
Before the wall was constructed fully, but after the city had been officially divided, what sort of movement was possible from the east side to the west side?
What sort of movement?
Yes.
You mean by car, by traffic,
by human beings? How were people able to cross, and how frequently did people cross before the wall was closed?
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, this is astonishing. Berlin was the only city after the war, well, World War II, where you still felt that something was unfinished in Germany, and that was the fact of the German division. You didn't feel that in Munich or in Hamburg or in Frankfurt. So you always felt there is still something to be done. Something has to be done about this division because there was this wall. Now, after the wall has been taken away, you have the impression in Berlin that's the only city where unification really has taken place. Berlin is now a total mix of West and East. You cannot distinguish them anymore. And if you look at a famous quarter, Prenzlauer Berg, you have an exchange of the population of 80%. 80% of the people you find in Prenzlauer Berg, which is East Berlin, haven't lived there 20 years ago. So there's an enormous movement and circulation.
At the time the wall first came down, was it easy to spot people, even though movement was allowed back and forth? Could you easily pick out a West German citizen from an East German, former East German citizen?
Yes, you did. It started with the clothing and even with the way they were looking at you or at the world. There was a kind of a lack of openness. You always felt they are cautious. They don't stare you into your eyes. They have lived under a dictatorship. They always had to fear that something could happen to them that they didn't expect. This, of course, is gone, but still, the chances of East Berliners, East Germans, in comparison with West Germans, to the very day, are very different. If you only take the fact that nobody in East Germany had any money. So if you see now all these castles rebuilt, villas rebuilt in East Germany, of course it's mostly West Germans who have the money to do this. And the East Germans, they look at that.
What are your most enduring memories of the night of November 9th?
What I was doing?
Yeah.
Well, it is a funny thing. Maybe it's even tragic. I had ridden once the wall jumper. I was predicting the wall would come down, and I was writing about the wall in the head. So I was a kind of an expert. And me, I was far away in Dartmouth College. And somebody was sticking his head into my office door and said, have you seen this? The wall has come down. And I said, you are crazy. I don't believe it. You know, these are the prophets who are not at the right place when the events happen. So I was totally surprised, of course. Then I had, I couldn't just break my contract. So I came back to Berlin a month later, 4 weeks later. But then I took my chance and asked everybody that I met, so how did you live through November 9th? And I collected the stories. There's a book that's called The German Comedy, where I wrote these stories.
Were you, I have to imagine it was extremely moving even to witness this on TV from half a world away. Did you cry all night, or how did you feel?
I did cry, yeah. First I didn't believe it, and then after I saw it, I had to believe it. And to my own amazement, I did cry. I'm actually not the kind of guy who's easily one who cries, but in this moment, this story was so overwhelming, and I think what it showed to the world that even Germans collectively can be, sympathetic. All the bad pictures about Nazi past, and this was for some weeks totally forgotten. You saw the celebrating Germans, the dancing Germans, the happy Germans, and some of it has remained. In the city of Berlin, I feel much more optimism than ever in the city. So the unification had actually won a new dimension of the time that was lacking in Berlin. It is called future. And Berlin now has, and I think, a very good future.
We're speaking this hour with journalist and author Peter Schneider about his new book, Berlin Now, The City After the Wall. We'll come back to the conversation and have hopefully a clearer line for you in just a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, talk about your experiences in Berlin, or ask a question, you can do that by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist, author, and college professor Peter Schneider. His new book is called Berlin Now, The City After the Wall. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Peter, the wall comes down, and in some ways, that's when the real work really starts of bringing together not
can
just...
Can you speak a little louder because I hardly hear you?
Yes. Let me see if we can turn up the volume for you.
Yeah.
On our... Is this better?
Yes, a little bit.
Okay, and maybe we can adjust that in our next break, and we'll
okay.
try and help you hear better. Can you talk a little bit about the hard work that happened after the fall of the wall to bring together not just people, but also infrastructure on the two sides of the city that had been divided?
Yeah, that was an enormous work, and it was actually done astonishingly fast. It's hard to believe, you know, all these connections, the streets, the canals, you know, the canals were also divided because they were not divided, but they were blocked because the East German Secret Service, they were fearing that people would escape through the canals. And so they blocked them, and all these things had to be done immediately after the unification. The center was a big hole. There was nothing. Potsdamer Platz. There were just two ruins remaining from after the war, and now it's one of the most populated square in Berlin. By the way, Potsdamer Platz was the most populated square in all of Europe. There was the first traffic light, and then it became a desert. Nothing was there, and all these enormous changes have been done in a way too short time. I feel we could have built better if we would have taken more time. I'm not very enthusiastic about the Potsdamer Platz. But again, the Potsdamer Platz might not be the most beautiful square in the world, but it is lively again. People go there, they like it, and Berliners are very curious, so if there's something new, they want to experience it. And so they are not, so that's not snobbish. So the city is actually changing every day, and a lot of things have to be done. As I said, we have to regain industry, jobs. Berlin always was on the top of the jobless cities in Germany, and it's changing right now. We have made really progress. Many people say Berlin is has a future as for startups. It will be one of the 10 cities where they think something big like Google or Microsoft could be invented in the future in this city.
How open is Berlin to the arrival of immigrants, particularly immigrants who don't come from European countries?
Yeah, that's a big problem. The whole Europe doesn't have a real immigration policy. And I think that's a shame. We should have, as Canada, as the United States, we should have an immigration policy which allows Africans and poor people from all over the world to come. And this, of course, in a controlled way. But as a matter of fact, they all come illegally, and then it depends on the region, on the mayors, how they cope with that. Berlin actually has been very generous. For instance, during the Bosnian War and the Kosovo War, we had, I think, 20,000 Bosnians only in Berlin. By the way, many of them have gone back now. But in recent times, there was just a group of immigrants who came illegally. via Italy and France. And they were, you know, living for half a year in tents in the midst of the city. And there were big fights about it. There were the leftist sympathizers who tried to help them. But this Berlin Center didn't find any solution for this problem. It's not something you can be proud of as Berliner.
Is there a Jewish population in Berlin today?
Yeah, that's one of the miracles. Only by the end of my research, I found out that that besides of the Jews who have lived for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years in Berlin, they came mostly from the east. But now we have 17 to 18,000 Israelis, young Israelis in Berlin, and they like the city. They feel at home in the city. They respect the fact that Berlin has faced its past as the capital of the Holocaust. There is no other city in the world where you have so many monuments and documents you can visit in Berlin which testify about this past. And then, interestingly, of course, the Israelis also come because of the clubs. Many of them are creative people, they are artists, high-tech engineers, and so forth and so on. I have talked to some of them, and my feeling is they don't want really to emigrate, but they want a break from the stress in Israel. And by the way, they were harshly criticized by the finance minister in Israel, who said, what are you doing over there in Berlin? Have you forgotten what was the destiny of your grandparents and so forth and so on? And instead of being shy to answer this critique, they really were very tough. They gave very tough replies, and they said, we want to have the same choices and chances as everybody else. You cannot prevent me from making my own choice where I want to live. And they really love Berlin, and they are not anymore so much looking only for the Holocaust monument and so forth. They are looking for jobs. They are befriending with young people there. They have their own now network. They have restaurants and circles where they meet. And it seems, to me, it was, to my generation, it was unthinkable that such a thing could happen. But it has happened, and it speaks actually well to Berlin.
Let's take a phone call now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mac on the line in South Dallas. Hi, Mac.
Hi. I retired from the Army in 1989 in Germany and lived in Fulda for a number of years, and I was there in November of 89 when the wall came down. And about that weekend, you couldn't hardly drive in town because of all the people that had come across. And this continued for about 4 or 5 months. Every weekend, they would just stay out of town because all the Easties came in, and they even made a park class out of the area in front of the Fulda Dome. And you could tell who they were because as they walked down the streets, they were loaded down with plastic sacks of everything that they couldn't buy.
Hmm.
I made several trips to Berlin, both before and after the wall, and the wall fell. And what was amazing was, as soon as you go across the wall, as soon as you went across the wall, the border there, it was like you had stepped back 40 years in time. Berlin never made any progress from 1933 forward. They were still having coal delivered in trucks, kindling. It was just the most god-awful atmosphere in the wintertime with the coal burning. It was, like I say, they lost from 1933 thereabouts of until 1989.
Does that match, Peter, with your observations as well?
In a certain way, yes. And actually, sometimes it felt that East Berlin, especially, but also East Germany, they were kind of living in a fridge, you know, and you would wonder what would come out if you defrost the fridge. As a matter of fact, this is, of course, a simplification because, they have lived in this totally inefficient system, and that's why they knew exactly that they wanted unification, because they wanted to take part in the success of West Germany. And it was the West Germans who were not so sure whether they wanted unification. But they had no choice. It was written in our constitution, if there's a chance, we have to unify. And it was Helmut Kohl who had this instinct and initiative, which most of the West German politicians had lost. I mean, if you look into the books and the history of unification, you will find that there was almost no politician except Willy Brandt and Helmut Kohl who still believed that unification could take place. But now we have seen it happened, and as a matter of fact, everyone, nobody wants to turn back the wheels of history. It has been a good thing for the Germans. I'm not so sure whether it was so good for Europe, because as a matter of fact, it turns out we are again somewhat too big.
Making other European neighbors nervous, particularly with regard to economic prosperity.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. When we discussed the fall of the wall, that's a little bit misleading. It had been very solidly constructed, and it didn't just crumble overnight. It had to be systematically deconstructed.
Yes.
So what was that process like?
Yeah, it was amazing. I have friends. I wasn't there, as I told you before. But I have friends who were there, and they were trying to hammer it away, but they couldn't do it. These are friends who really know how to use a hammer and chisels, but they couldn't do it because this was armed cement. It was highly resistant, and you couldn't just bring it down with your hands. You needed really big machines to bring it down. It took more than a year to do away with the wall, and actually many pieces, as you know, have been sold to many museums, to rich people who have it in their garden. But the big rest of the wall was became sand again, and was used for the highways. The new highways that you see in East Germany going from Berlin now to the east, there under your car, you find the rest of the wall. It was used for the highways. And so after all this terrible building named wall was for some use again.
Is there a divide in the culture of Berlin residents between the people who remember the wall and its significance and those who were born after the fall?
That's a very interesting question. I myself, who has actually defined this expression, the wall and the hat, I was surprised how long it would last. I thought that for the adults who were educated in both different systems, so in the West and in the East, the wall would never really disappear. But it would disappear, it wouldn't even exist for the ones who were born in 89 or after 89. But it turns out that is not true, because the differences, the cultural differences, are so deep, and the experience of the East Germans, it was so harsh and different from the West Germans' experience, that this marks also their kids. kids are the kids of their parents, and so they listen to their parents. And so what you find is that many attitudes that you would think they are overcome by after 25 years are sometimes still there, and people see the history different, totally different. I was reminded, you know, when I first came to the United States, I was amazed that the history of the Civil War in America is seen totally different by New Yorkers, for instance, or by people in the South. Mm-hmm. If you go to the museums, you find a different history. And in part, that's also true for Germany, and that will last for a long time.
My guest is journalist, author, and college professor Peter Schneider. We're talking about his new book, Berlin Now, The City After the Wall. If you'd like to share a story or ask a question, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author Peter Schneider. We're talking about his book, Berlin Now, The City After the Wall. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Peter, one thing that really surprised me about your book is that I was under the impression, as I think many Americans are, that the rise of the Nazis essentially killed, at least temporarily, the club culture, the night culture of Berlin. And you tell us that that was never entirely the case.
That's right. That's what I believe too before I started to research it. As a matter of fact, you know, it turns out that Berlin was culturally never totally conquered by the Nazis. There were always pockets of, well, there were a lot of resistant people. There were communists. There was a nightlife that never stopped. A lot of homosexuals, prostitutes. By the way, many prostitutes had been helping and hiding persecuted people, Jews and other people in Germany. They even got honored for that in after 45 by the senator of Berlin, but he had a problem to shake hands with the former prostitutes. Well, culturally, the Nazis were completely successful in Munich, not so in Berlin. And I researched in one of my books what was the destiny of Jews who had been hidden in Berlin during the Nazi years. And as a matter of fact, there's no other city in Germany by far where a number like 1,500 Jews have been successfully hidden. And that was an entertaining, that was not as easy as it sounds. You couldn't just stay for years and years in the same basement. You always had to change the apartment and the hiding spot, and so many people had to be engaged in order to make it possible. This is a story that many Berliners even don't know. But when I started to tell some of these stories, they say, yeah, I know another story, and so forth and so on. There is also kind of positive, a very small positive past in those years. And rightly, our president said, it's a shame that our students know the names and characters of the perpetrators way better than the names of the few heroic helpers.
Yeah, you've noted that you think maybe in its eagerness to ensure that the legacy of the Holocaust is not forgotten, that maybe students are missing out on some of the people who tried very hard not to allow the Nazis to operate.
And I really think that to the very day, we are teaching these stories in the classrooms very often in a wrong way. Why was it that in Schindler's List, this great movie by Spielberg, he singled out just one example that is, of course, not a representative example, one man who was involved with the Nazi Party, but he saved 1,000 Jews. Why did he do that? Because Spielberg said or thought we need a positive example. We need to show somebody who shows a way out of all this horror and this passivity and this obedience. There must be a way out. And I think that has happened too rarely in our education of the Holocaust.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Diane in Highland Village. Hi, Diane.
Hi. My husband and I had visited Berlin several years ago, and it was one of the best vacations we ever had. It was very interesting because both of us are very interested in the Holocaust and World War II. But I just wanted to make a comment, and maybe it's a little bit different than the guest comment.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe it's not a very good follow-up, but I was impressed by the need to address the Holocaust and to kind of make amends for it. There's a lot. It seemed like there was a lot of education in Berlin with all the attractions and all the, you know, exhibits that really, in opposition to the way the Japanese have dealt with their role in World War II, that the German people, and especially in Berlin, there's been a real need to be able to address what had gone on so as not to repeat it again. And we had taken a tour of Sachsenhausen, and the young man who was in his late 20s was talking about, well, for one thing, it was free just because he felt that tour company felt that it was its duty to make sure that as many people could visit Sachsenhausen to know the history of the place and what had happened. And so I felt that the there was really a desire by the German people to really address that. And this young man, his parents weren't even in World War II. It was his grandparents. But
Diane, thank you so much for your comments. I want to make sure, because we're getting close to the end, Peter, that you have a chance to comment on that.
Yeah, I find that very interesting. And I actually wanted to know when the guest was in Sachsenhausen, because I have to say here something. You know, all these places of commemoration, the concentration camps, in the former East, in East Germany, they were totally different than the ones that we know from the West, because in the communist history writing, the real victims of Nazi Germany were first the communists. And the Jews were only named after many other groups. And in West Germany, it was just the opposite. Of course, the highest number of victims were the Jews, then the Gypsies, the homosexuals. And at the very end, they named the communists, which also had a lot of victims, by the way, especially prisoners of war. Now, this different writing of history, this split history writing is over now, and it's only since 95 that the whole personnel in the that you find in former concentration camps, that the guides that lead you now, they give you a different instruction about what happened and a more precise instruction what happened. I was completely astonished when I visited some concentration camps right after the fall of the wall about the strange writing of history and the false writing of history that I found there.
Let's go back to the phones. This time we have Jimmy on the line in Bedford. Hi, Jimmy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Dr. Schneider about Tempelhof. Flughafen-Tempelhof.
Flughafen-Tempelhof.
I would like to, for you to tell us something about what has happened to that building complex. I lived there for two and a half years in 1950s, from 1956 until 1958. So I still have those wonderful pictures and memories of Berlin of that era. I have worried since then about what might happen to Flughafen-Tempelhof. Is it still there? I know plans were made to keep it as some kind of monument.
Well, let's find out for you, Jimmy. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay. Flughafen-Tempelhof. You might know that it was decided to shut it down. And so there is no airplane there anymore that is flying or landing. But the building is there. The building is still in use. There are some shows there, but very irregular. There's no regular use of the building. The interesting thing is that the Landebahn, where the airplanes roll, how do you call this?
Runway.
The runways, mm-hmm. Yeah. The runways are open to the public now. You see a lot of skyscrapers and all kinds of vehicles that with the sailing advice and so forth. There's a lot of use of Tempelhofer Feld, but now the city had to make a decision. Berlin becomes bigger, 50 inhabitants each year, so we have to offer them something. And there was a group, as it always happens in Berlin, there's always a protest about anything and discussion and debate on anything. They said, no, we want to preserve Tempelhofer Feld, this runway, 100%. We don't want to have any construction there. And astonishingly, against the mayor, against many citizens, including me, this initiative won. So it is for the years to come, it's not possible to build anything on these runways. I find it a little bit crazy, because I think we have to offer some housing, affordable housing, to the many people now who want to live in Berlin, and we cannot send them to the outskirts.
You have a wonderful story in the book of the surprising path taken at the Palace of the Republic in the eastern part of the city, and how during the years it was supposed to be taken down, it was also kind of reclaimed by people.
Yeah, this was one of the many symbolic fights that I liked so much about this Berlin story, and I tried to revive them. It was actually there was the People's Palace in Mitte, in the center of East Berlin, and before the Palace of the Republic had been built, there was at this very spot the Hohenzollern Schloss. So this was the castle of the Hohenzollern, this noble family where the Prussian kings and Kaisers came from. And this was completely teared down during the communist years. And now many felt after the war came down that we had to rebuild the castle. But others said this is the Prussian tradition that will be revived. The Prussians have made so much terrible things in history. We don't want to honor this this history. We don't want the Prussian virtues to come back. Then there was a fight about whether this was true. Did they really use the Hohenzollern Schloss, the Schloss as it's called? Did they use it? No, it turns out they hardly ever used it. They Hitler never entered the Schloss. And so there were different, again, different views that became very pragmatic and realistic because you had to make decisions. And then one guy, it was really one person who was obsessed with the castle, he made it happen that the Schloss now is going to be rebuilt. He had one trick. He managed to convince some rich friends to finance a fake of the facade of the Schloss.
Hmm.
And so it happened that for 2 years, if you would go unter den Linden towards east, you would see the painted castle, but in the whole dimension of it.
I'm sorry, but
I'm
going to have to stop you in the middle of the story because we are out of time. The new book by Peter Schneider is called Berlin Now, The City After the Wall. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
I thank you very much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Connect and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.